Coming up today on the Bill Kelly Podcast, reaction to the new masking guidelines from Dr. Kieran Moore with Dr. Anna Banerjee of the University of Toronto. Carmi Levy, the tech analyst and journalist, will try to wade through all the rough waters of Twitter. And Global News Washington correspondent Reggie Jacchini on will he or won't he? What is Trump going to do? I'm Shona Thompson, filling in on the Bill Kelly Podcast, which starts right now.
The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on 900 CHML.
In the first part of the show, we went live to Dr. Kieran Moore's news conference, who is strongly recommending masking at all indoor settings. He's recommending masking in schools. He's recommending masking in homes. If you are going to be exposed to young children, he said adults can easily transmit some of the key viruses that are filling up our children's hospitals. Wanted to find out a little bit more about what's going on and what these three viruses are. And so we have reached out to Dr. Anna Banerjee, who's with the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Toronto. Dr. Banerjee, thank you for your time.
Oh, my pleasure.
So the recommendation is for us, as I mentioned, to wear masks, but it's a strong recommendation. It's not an actual mandate. And it seems in the news conference, at least, that Dr. Kieran Moore was almost a little bit more concerned about RSV and the flu and the impact that's having on young children, and that he seems to indicate that that is leading to the surge that we're seeing at children's hospitals. Can you give us some background on what RSV is, as well as how the flu is really impacting on kids?
Okay, so RSV is a common respiratory virus that we see every year. Usually we see every year, and it comes in cycles. And for older people, it can give a cold-like illness. But the problem is that younger people, especially ones that have never been exposed to it before, it can cause inflammation of the airway and cause something called bronchiolitis, and which can be like a mild cold-like illness all the way to life-threatening bronchiolitis, where children need to be put on a breathing machine, ventilated, and you know, and sometimes it can be fatal. So right now, what we have is we have the baseline Omicron, but we have an early RSV season, and lots of kids are getting sick and hospitalized with RSV, much more than a typical season, because kids have not been exposed to RSV for the past few years, and so we're having a lot more kids being admitted to the hospital in the ICU than before.
Well, and we're also hearing a lot about the flu. In fact, Dr. Moore was saying at one of the children's hospitals that he had been in touch with that he was being told that the pediatric ICU was full, and half the patients were RSV, the other half were flu. But I mean, just talking about the flu, that doesn't really tell us what kind of flu, why it's infecting children so dramatically.
So it's the same kind of thing, where influenza, in the past few years with the masking and the public health measures, both influenza, RSV, and other viruses were really not being spread. So you have a whole bunch of young children who are being exposed to these viruses for the first time. And so, you know, normally kids get sick during the seasons, but now we have a whole bunch of kids getting sick at the same time. And so, you know, it's both RSV and influenza are starting early this year, and so that on top of COVID is very concerning.
Do we have any indication yet as to whether the flu shot that we're being given now, and if I recall correctly, they started distributing them around the 1st of November, if this mixture of flu vaccine is effective against the flu that we're seeing in the kids?
I'm not sure yet. We'll have to see what. The flu season is just starting, so we have to see what the circulating strain is and how well this vaccine matches that strain. So I'm not sure yet.
And how important, in your medical opinion, is masking to help prevent the overcapacity that we're seeing in children's hospitals?
Masking is critical right now. So both RSV, influenza, and the other viruses, they're droplet spread. A lot of people believe that Omicron is also airborne. So with droplet spread, wearing a mask really does help prevent the transmission. And so if you have kids, like, you know, for older kids, they might get a cold and you don't think it's a big deal. But then if that cold, which is actually RSV, spreads, and someone takes it home to their younger sibling, then that child could end up in the ICU or end up in the hospital. So, you know, masking, because it's droplet spread, will be very, very important for preventing the spread of RSV and influenza, just because right now we're at a crisis because all these kids are getting sick at the same time.
Well, I know I was mentioning earlier that certainly at McMaster Children's Hospital in Hamilton, they're at 140% capacity. That was based on numbers from Friday. I'm not sure what the numbers are going to be today.
Yeah, this is a crisis. And this is, you know, where they're strongly recommending people wearing masks. Well, there are people say, I'm tired of COVID. I don't want to wear a mask. It's inconvenient. I'm tired of this. But they're not understanding that we're trying to save children's lives and children's suffering. And at a time when we don't have ibuprofen or acetaminophen, and a lot of antibiotics are not in stock. And so I don't think, you know, saying it's a recommendation, people think, yeah, it's a good idea to wear the mask, I don't have to. But really what we're trying to do is prevent this crisis from getting worse. And I strongly believe it should have been mandated, especially in schools, because we need to get this under control, because there's a limit to the amount that it could, that we can increase the ICUs and the hospital beds. I think they're trying to do everything they can, but there's a limit to it. And so the best thing is really prevention.
Well, I don't know if you've had a chance to see the latest Garson forecasting for the next wave. And frankly, I've lost count as to which wave we are in right now. But we had been warned that a couple of weeks ago that this triple threat was going to make this wave very, very hard on children's hospitals. We're not even anywhere near the peak, and we're running at over capacity at all 7 children's hospitals across the province.
Yes, yes. And even in August, I was saying we shouldn't get rid of the masking in schools. We have all these kids getting together. A lot of the younger kids are not vaccinated against Omicron, and you have them breathing the same airspace. And if you take away the masks, all of a sudden you're having Omicron spread, but then the added burden of RSV and other respiratory viruses. This was predictable.
Well, yeah, I know we're like it's showing that we're going to hit the peak sometime around the end of the year, perhaps into early January. If we start masking now everywhere, do we have a chance to change that tide?
I think there's still going to be RSV and influenza, but it's not. You can pretty drastically reduce the transmission by having the masks. As we saw in the past few years, there was hardly any RSV or influenza because people were masking, you know, and kids were not at school. The combination of having these kids in school without masks when a lot of them are not exposed or their siblings are not exposed is causing this crisis. And so we really need to get the kids and everyone masked again, basically to prevent things from even getting worse.
We've been speaking with Dr. Anna Banerjee with the Faculty of Medicine at the University of Toronto about masking and the impacts it could have on mitigating the crisis, as she put it, the crisis in children's hospitals. Dr. Banerjee, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
You're listening to the Bill Kelly Show podcast on 900 CHML.
You know, there's an old saying, or is it a curse? May you live in interesting times. And the times have been very interesting, none the least of which at Twitter, particularly so since Elon Musk showed up on the scene. It was a pretty wild weekend. If you went on Twitter, you saw some parodies, some people testing the verification waters by getting verified accounts for celebrities or other big names that were not them, proving how easy it was to do that even under the new rules, and Elon Musk responding. Reporter Matt Gutman explains why some analysts are saying Twitter may be joining other non-extinct sites.
We reached out to Twitter for comment, got no response. Now, analysts are telling us that with advertisers jumping ship, it's possible that Twitter, often called the world's public square, could go the way of AOL or MySpace and just become obsolete.
You know, not getting a response from Twitter is probably one of the most ironic things I've heard in the last several days. Joining us now is Carmi Levy. He is the person we turn to for tech analysis. He's also a journalist, and he's on the line with us now. Hi, Carmi.
Hello, Shona. So great to be here with you. You're absolutely right. These are the most interesting of times for Twitter, although some days I think we could all wish for a little bit less interest there. I think maybe if it were a little bit less chaotic, we'd all probably be better served.
Well, you know, if you're sitting on the sidelines, it's kind of like watching a tennis match back and forth and back and forth.
Yeah, or tennis match or, you know, slow motion train wreck, barn fire, dumpster fire. Take your pick. It is. I think we all knew it would be kind of chaotic when Elon Musk decided to take over when he initially made his offer back in April. We sort of knew what was coming, but I don't think anyone expected it to be this over the top. I mean, he literally seems to be, it's almost like watching a pinball skittering from one side of the other. One side to the other, from bouncing between bumpers. There really isn't a plan. There's no roadmap. I don't think Elon Musk really has a strategy. He's just reacting to whatever crisis seems to be burning most brightly in front of him right now. And he doesn't have a press team anymore. He got rid of them, and he is the press team. Just follow his feed on Twitter, and you'll kind of know what's happening next, no matter how crazy that might be.
Well, now, Carmi, they do say that businesses take on the personality of the owner.
I'm okay with that. I mean, you know, it's ironic because Twitter, of course, was co-founded by Jack Dorsey, who's no longer there, but he's, you know, rather famously, you know, kind of a bit of an eccentric character himself. And the tech industry has no shortage of individuals who have been larger than life. Look no further than Steve Jobs or Jeff Bezos or Bill Gates. I mean, these are all people who command the room, and history will remember them for better or for worse, but we'll remember them. And Elon Musk is no different. And you know, but I think the difference here is he has been successful at other companies for very different reasons. He has revolutionized rocketry, reusable rockets with the Falcon 9 for SpaceX. He has revolutionized the automotive industry, pushed it in the direction of electric vehicles or EVs, where they famously didn't want to do that for decades. And so this is a guy who disrupts industries. He's a brilliant engineer who knows how to surround himself with the right technical minds to solve previously unsolvable problems. And we know he's somewhat mercurial. We know he's a little bit out there, kind of like Howard Hughes-like almost. But then he gets to Twitter and all bets are off. It's, you know, there's really no sign of that engineering excellence. He doesn't seem to know what he's doing. And that emotional non-intelligence that we kind of suspected was there all along, well, it's on display for everyone to see. And so I have a funny feeling that his win streak of companies that he has turned around and turned into globe-changing entities might be stopping with Twitter.
Well, I mean, isn't that part of the problem in the other companies? As you pointed out, he put the right people in and relied on their expertise. But here at Twitter, the first thing he does is fire everybody.
I think that's exactly it, is that, you know, at all of his other companies, he has been intelligent enough to ensure that there are adults in the room. And so, for example, if you look at SpaceX, the senior leaders at SpaceX, led by Gwynne Shotwell, who's his chief operating officer, are veterans of the space industry, people who had worked for and with NASA or in the rocketry industry. So he knows to kind of let them do the day-to-day, and then he comes in and helps with some of the engineering. But really, if he disappears or falls off a cliff, SpaceX will be just fine. Same thing with Tesla. Even though he gets a lot of headlines sometimes for sleeping on the factory floor, truth of the matter is he's hired a lot of really smart people who have figured out the ins and outs of mass producing cars and of producing software that the big three really haven't even dreamed of yet. And so, but with Twitter, for whatever reason, that hasn't seemed to have dawned on him yet. He still seems to be running it like a one-man show, lopped off senior leaders as soon as he came in. And then there was a second wave of senior leaders quitting on him. And now just over the weekend, he's getting rid of the contractors who are responsible for content moderation. So thousands more people being shown the door, and he keeps making promises for all these new features. And I have to keep asking, well, who's going to actually work on them, and who's going to lead the staff who are left, who are probably all freaking out and updating their resumes as we speak? who's going to make sure that they stick around to make all these changes that you're promising? So I just don't see where that's happening. And honestly, based on people I know who have worked for Twitter or who are working for Twitter, none of that work is happening internally right now. So he's just speaking in his feed, but in the background, it's all chaos.
Well, I guess this is the big question. Are these just growing pains with a new owner, or is Twitter in some real big trouble?
I think anytime there is a new regime in place, and I've worked for enough companies in and out of tech as they move through mergers and acquisitions. And so I think anyone knows that anytime there's a new sheriff in town, there is going to be a bit of an upset. They are going to bring in some of their own people. They're going to change the rules. They're going to want to put their stamp on things and send the right message. This is my landscape now. I make the rules now, especially someone like Elon Musk, who already was the world's richest man. But I think this is on a whole other level. This isn't just growing pains. This isn't just, you know, we've got a new owner. This is the master of chaos doing what sadly he seems to do best, which is sow chaos, sow dissension. And I don't think he really understands. I think he understands really well what he has deconstructed, and he's pulled the Twitter machine apart. And let's be honest, it did need help beforehand. This was not a company that was healthy before Elon Musk came along. It needed a rebuild. It needed a restart, transformation. But you know, now that he's taken it all apart, I don't think he knows how to put it back together again. And Humpty Dumpty is sitting on the wall and he has no idea what comes next.
One of the things that I've heard is that there's been a massive devaluation of Twitter, that it obviously he bought it for $44 billion and now it's supposed to be worth like $8 billion. But of course, that was a tweet on Twitter. So, you know, who knows if that's true?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'm same thing. Because it's privately held now, we don't really know what the finances are. And that's deliberate. And I get it. But at the same time, it's pretty clear that there wasn't a lineup of multi-billionaires standing with checkbooks in hand waiting to pay $44 billion for the company. So I think general consensus is he way overpaid. And, you know, there are many analysts who say that it was by a factor of two, if not more. I say more. But the sad truth is that now Twitter is under the gun financially for a decision that Elon Musk made. In other words, it has to make money so that Elon Musk is not forced to essentially eat that $44 billion purchase price. And so through no fault of its own, Twitter now is in a fiscal crisis. And at the same time, Elon Musk is alienating advertisers who now are abandoning the platform in droves. Advertising agencies that place advertisers on the platform are telling their clients, do not put your ads on, wait for this to blow over. So suddenly the advertising revenue, which is 90% of Twitter's revenue before the takeover occurred, has now basically ground to a halt at the same time that Elon Musk is staring at his financial worth, thinking, oh my God, Twitter's going to drain me dry. So frightening place to be. And if you're a Twitter employee and you still have a job, you're shrugging your shoulders going, I had nothing to do with this. And why am I suddenly being forced to pay the price for a billionaire who made the wrong decision? It's a good question. Unfortunately, the only person who can answer it is Mr. Musk.
And it's not the only time that question has been asked in business with a new owner. Carmi, we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. And no doubt we'll have an opportunity to talk maybe even later this week.
I will keep watching, I promise. And I'll make the popcorn too.
Okay, fair enough. Carmi Leamy is a tech analyst and a journalist.
You're listening to the Bill Kelly Show podcast on 900 CHML.
So much has been going on down in the United States. The U.S. election cycle seems to never be ending. And that has just been through another round because of the midterms. So much has been happening with Canada's largest trading partner. And, you know, we're still trying to figure out who's actually running the joint. Joining us now from Washington is Reggie Jacchini. He is the Global News correspondent from Washington. Good morning, Reggie.
Good morning.
How are you keeping up with everything that's going on there?
I mean, look, elections last a long time in this country. We know that elections can take a long time to try and, clean up and get towards the very end. And then it's just a bit of a downturn before we eventually move into the next election. So, I mean, it's kind of never ending. So you never really kind of get a hold of it, because once it's done, there's always another one right around the corner.
Yeah. In this one, I mean, you know, you're quite correct. They have a much larger population than we have. So there's lots of votes to be counted. And the mail-in ballots seem to be one of the areas that's taking a long time. And every state seems to have different rules with regards to those mail-in ballots. So I guess that's one of the reasons why it's taking so long to find out who's in control.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, unlike in Canada, there is no kind of federal election, watchdog or oversight agency, and everything is really up to the individual state. And that's why some states allow for mail-in ballots. That's why some states allow for more drop boxes than others on election day. And that really leads to a number of issues, Shona. Number one being, rampant conspiracy theories about why things are happening in one state and not in another state. But it really does, as you mentioned, add to the delay. In somewhere like California, the most populous state, tens of millions of people, mail-in ballots are given to everybody. And California gets something like 37 or 38 days after Election Day to be able to formally certify their votes because it simply takes so long to count and tabulate all of the votes that are coming in. And in California alone, there are still roughly 10 races that don't have a call at all. And that is an important number when you factor in the fact that there is simply no kind of control of Congress, at least when it comes to the House of Representatives right now, because there are so many outstanding races and the race for control is simply so close.
Well, and I mean, we know that the Democrats are going to have the balance of power in the Senate, but doesn't that kind of rest on everybody showing up every single time for every single vote?
Yes, it does. And I think that there is there's a potential here for a little bit of wiggle room, at least when it comes to the Senate. And that's because for the last 2 years, it's been evenly divided. 50 senators Republican, 50 senators Democrat. And then in order to pass something, the vice president, Kamala Harris, comes in and casts a tie-breaking ballot, because in the U.S., the vice president acts as the president of the Senate. I think with this Senate kind of race, we're watching for what happens at the runoff election in Georgia between football star Herschel Walker and incumbent Raphael Warnock. If Democrats manage to kind of eke out a win there, if they're able to grab that additional Senate seat, it gives them 51. It doesn't need to mean that there's a tie-breaking vote, you know, on a regular basis, but it also means even if there's a bit of a split in the Democratic Party, say someone who's a little bit more moderate, like Joe Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema, Democrats could still get something passed through with 50 and then a 50 plus one with the vice president. So the balance of control is there. It means that people need to show up. But if trends continue, Democrats will have kind of a little bit more breathing room when it comes to how they move forward with votes.
Well, and Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, those are very important names, because those are two that should be voting with the Democrats. But so often it almost seems like they're sitting back going, you want my vote? What are you going to give me?
Well, and it's important to remember, too, especially with Joe Manchin, you know, West Virginia is not a Democrat-friendly state. It's an incredibly red state. I believe it's a Trump plus 10 or more state. And so when you have someone like Joe Manchin, who's been able to kind of garner the trust of voters within West Virginia because he takes a much more kind of moderate position or conservative position within the Democratic Party, he's essentially able to caucus with the Democrats, but get what he wants for his state of West Virginia. The same with someone like Kyrsten Sinema, who was really kind of intensely left wing at one point and really kind of moved towards the center. If they're less important now, by way of being able to control the agenda, because their vote might not be a make or break, that could give the Democrats a bit of an ability here to say, well, look, we're going to put this policy first because we know that we're already going to have 50 plus one, even if we lose out on one of the more moderates. So this is a big win, a big gain for the Democrats. The House is where everybody's watching to see what happens next.
Well, yeah, and that's a really key thing because, you know, I mean, there are some who are saying, you know, it's possible, mathematically anyway, that the Democrats could also control the House. That's unheard of in midterms.
Absolutely. I mean, look, midterm elections oftentimes move in the opposite direction of the controlling party in the White House. And whether it's history or whether it's trends, this should have been an election for Republicans to be able to run away with and get over, if not overwhelming majorities, kind of guaranteed majorities in one or both sections of Congress. But simply, the polling was underestimated. There was an underestimation when it came to how Americans broadly would embrace the overturning of Roe v. Wade. And Democrats did better. And you're right. Mathematically, there is a real chance here that Democrats could take a very small one or two seat majority. But at the same time, Shona, there is also that real possibility that Republicans are going to walk away with a majority in the House, But again, not a 5, 10, 15, 20, 40 seat majority, a 1 or 2 seat majority. And they could find themselves in the same position the Senate was in with Democrats, where a couple of people from within the Republican conference are really able to control the agenda, control the investigations, control the stalling of the president's agenda, because they know without those couple of votes, Republicans wouldn't have it, and it would fall into the Democrats' laps here. So this House race is kind of incredibly important here to figure out what's going to be stalled and what's kind of going to fall into the laps of Democrats over the next couple of years.
Well, and it also brings up something else, and that would be, you know, the health of some of the older members of Congress. You know, and you'd hate to see it come down to something like that. But again, it's sort of like the Ruth Bader Ginsburg scenario. And you know, the death of one of those people could change everything.
Absolutely, it could. I mean, in the House, you know, age obviously plays a factor here. But when you have 435 members of the House of Representatives, you know, numbers don't kind of make as big of an important, you know, I guess with a small majority it does, but the numbers don't always need to kind of fall directly in line. In the somewhere like the Senate, that's where things could get difficult. And there have been calls for term limits when it comes to senators. And reason being, the senior senator of the United States Senate is a Republican, Chuck Grassley from Iowa. He is 89 years old. He won his reelection, meaning if he, you know, survives for his term, he'll be 94 years old, still sitting as an active senator. On the flip side, Dianne Feinstein, she has been a kind of political stalwart in the United States for years, going all the way back to Harvey Milk in San Francisco. She is now the most senior Democrat, again, 89 years old, anticipating to run for re-election, despite there have been stories about health concerns, you know, with abilities when it comes to memory. She's intended to run again for the next 2 years, but also at the same time, the most senior person of the party who controls the Senate is the Senate pro tempore, who finds themselves fourth in line to the presidency after the House Speaker. So now all of a sudden age is crucial here. You have somebody who's that old in line, but also somebody that's that old making decisions about laws who, you know, unfortunately might not be alive within a couple of years to see the laws through or get the votes passed. So you're right. Age is a huge factor here, but the Congress in the U.S. just isn't moving in a young direction.
Well, I don't think it ever has. But there's something else I wanted to touch on, and I know we only have a few minutes left with you. And this is really important because, as you mentioned, it was a key reason why this midterm election has been so close, and that is Roe v. Wade. And we heard this morning that President Joe Biden says that he doubts that there are enough votes in Congress to codify abortion rights across the United States.
This could become a massive player in 2024. Look, in October, the president said the first thing that he would do if his party had both chambers would be to codify Roe make abortion legal across the country. They have the votes in the Senate if they're able to abolish the filibuster. They don't have the votes in the House. And he said that this morning while he was in Bali, saying that he doesn't think that the House is going to have those votes unless something unusual happens. Well, what does that mean? It means that Republican states or Republican-held states can continue to enact restrictions, you know, for the time being. But in 2024, given how we saw that Democrats kind of rushed forward to try and protect women's health care by voting for more Democrats during the midterm than had been anticipated, if those restrictions continue, that could put Republicans in real hot water in 2024 if it throws even more Democrats out there. Because while Republicans sit there and potentially go into investigations about Joe Biden and Joe Biden's son and issues having to do with COVID, Democrats are going to latch onto the issues that Americans that they believe intently care about. And this could come back to bite the Republican Party if they opt to do nothing when it comes to women's health care.
Yeah, that could be a really key issue. I think you're right there. So is there anything on your day timer for tomorrow? Say, Trump?
Look, I mean, this is a big deal. This was an anticipated speech a couple of weeks ago when Trump said that he was very, very probably going to make an announcement. And then last week, and he said that he was going to probably make an announcement. Well, probably and very probably is now on Tuesday. He's expected to make this announcement that he's dipping his toes into the 2024 race at a time when a significant number of his candidates that he kind of gave the Trump blessing to came up short and Republicans lost an ability to get majorities because of Donald Trump. Him entering the race now is going to be a real test of soul searching within the Republican Party to figure out, do we continue to follow along with him or do we continue to keep Trumpism alive? or do we revert back to kind of original conservatism in the United States? This is going to be a key moment, a key test for Republicans when Donald Trump makes this announcement, if Donald Trump makes this announcement.
Well, Washington is never boring.
It's never boring. And Donald Trump keeps Washington interesting. It keeps people on their toes, and it keeps the Republican Party in a position of not being able to figure out how to move forward. And it allows Democrats to latch on to that. That's why we saw what happened take place in the midterms. And that's why we potentially could see 2024 become another fight that could be Republicans to win, that Democrats are able to keep them on their toes.
Well, it's always interesting. And I really enjoy speaking with you, Reggie. And no doubt we're going to have more opportunities to dissect what's going on down in Washington.
A runoff election is in Georgia. So I said there's always an election around the corner. There's an election in Georgia 3 weeks from now.
Awesome. Our Washington correspondent for Global News, Reggie Jacchini.
The Bill Kelly Show, weekdays from 9 to noon on 900 CHML.
The Bill Kelly Podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. You can also listen to The Bill Kelly Show weekdays from 9 till noon on 900 CHML. I'm Bill Kelly. Thanks again for listening. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. It's free, so you never miss an episode. And make sure that you rate and review.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink. All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.